Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I'm making a note here, huge success. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And guys, you know, I have this problem. I was using my computer the other day to work on a non-trivial math problem, and it gave me an estimated time of completing that particular task as 478 years. And I've got plans that day. I'm actually washing my hair. So I was hoping that maybe we could talk about classical computers, how they process information, and maybe
about why you're still washing your hair in your cyborg body in 500 years.
Well, in 500 years, his cyborg body has hair.
Yeah, actually,
but
only,
it takes all day to wash.
Yeah. Only my body has hair. But yes, it's you know, I don't want to go too far into my personal details here. So we all understand classical computers are reading machine language, binary language, zeros and ones. Technically, there's actually something electronic going on there, but we're specifically saying that, you know, it interprets information in sequences of zeros and ones that represent other things.
Yeah. Any piece of software running on your computer is actually a really long, generally really long sequence of on and off switches.
Yes.
Of ones and zeros.
Right. And it's following specific rules.
Yeah. And so there are two options it has to work with. It has on and off, zero
yep.
and one, or one and zero, would represent, well,
yes.
whatever.
On and off would be one and zero. Yes.
Right. And everything that it does has to be translated down to that level before the hardware can make use of it.
Right, because the hardware doesn't understand things like run Assassin's Creed 4. It actually has to break it down into machine
language. No, it understands 1011010.
Right.
But if you tell it that run equals 10110011,
right.
et cetera,
right.
then...
Yeah, if you establish what the rules are, then it can interpret it through multiple levels of translating from whatever language you're using into machine language, that binary system. So this sort of approach is really good for certain types of operations. For example, if you want something just really simple, like you want to multiply one number by another number, and you input that into the computer, and it understands what the operation is, it understands how to multiply, then, and by understand, I mean it has the instructions to do so, not that it actually comprehends.
Probably.
So, yeah. You can listen to our artificial intelligence episode and hear that whole argument again. But the idea being that it does that very well. It can do that operation quickly. You get it, you know, if you use a calculator, you're going to get that information very quickly. That's a
probably
very simplified computer.
More quickly than a human being could.
Certainly.
Oh,
yeah.
Process
than most,
that.
Than most human beings, yes.
Yeah. Your classic computer is very good at math, and it's very good at doing lots and lots of math problems way faster than you can.
But if it needs to do a whole series of those in order to get the one result you want, because the question you're asking is actually going to require many, many, many operations before you can get an answer, that's where the classical computers start to slow down. Even when we're talking about modern classical computers, which often have multi-cores, right? You know, you hear about these multi-core processors. They can break down certain types of problems into parallel chunks, and each core of the processor can work on a chunk of that problem, which cuts down on the amount of time it takes to solve the overall question that you've asked. But even then, it's, you know, you're talking about like maybe 16 cores. That's still nothing if you're talking about a truly difficult problem. And that's traditionally where we run into a barrier with classical computers. There are certain types of non-trivial problems that classical computers have trouble solving. Here's an example. We've talked about it before, the traveling salesman problem.
Right.
You know, the idea that you've got a traveling salesman who needs to visit, let's say, 10 cities, and your job is to try and find the most efficient route for that traveling salesman to go through to spend the least amount of energy on this trip. And there are a lot of different potential ones to choose from, you know, choosing city A first and then going to city D and then going back to city B or going straight through. And really you don't know what the right answer is until you've compared all those options. And as you add cities to this question, it becomes more and more difficult to answer. And a classical computer, essentially what it has to do is go through and run every single possibility. And then at the end of running all of them, compare all the results together to come up with your answer, which can take a long time. So that means that we need to look at maybe an alternative to classical computing if we want to be able to solve those types of problems in a more efficient, faster manner.
No, but how do we get more efficient than a bit? I mean, on or off seems like a pretty simplified.
Well, what if you could be both on and off at the same time?
That's crazy talk.
It is crazy talk.
Jonathan,
yes.
I have never seen a light switch that was both off and on at the same time.
No wonder you haven't seen it. If you had observed it, it would either be off or on.
Yeah, what do you know?
You can't see it and see it that it's both off and on at the same time. Then you've observed it.
Well, the problem is because a light switch is actually a really huge thing.
Yeah, it's a macro level thing.
It's on our scale.
Yes.
So its position tends to be pretty stable, right?
Yeah, but if we're looking at things on, say, a quantum scale, that subatomic, tiny world where things
like
just don't make sense.
A photon or an electron?
Yeah, we're talking like tiny little particles. They exhibit behaviors that if that same behavior were to suddenly exhibit itself on the macro scale, on our scale, we would all just think that we had been sucked into some sort of David Lynch weird alternate universe.
Timey-wimey. Yeah.
Nothing would make sense.
No, nothing would make sense because the quantum world and the classical world are very different in the way they behave.
Well, yeah, our intuitions are evolved to deal with, you know, like trees and rocks and animals.
Yeah, not things existing in superposition.
And furthermore, trees and rocks and animals that don't suddenly shift 3 miles to the right for no apparent reason.
Okay,
So what are we talking about? How can something be in two positions at once?
It is called superposition. And asking me how is the wrong way to go about it, Joe, because I certainly could not tell you how. I could tell you what's going on here. So superposition is a concept within the field of quantum engineering, quantum mechanics, where a subatomic particle is able to coexist in multiple states at the same time. And I don't mean states like the United States. I'm talking about actual states of being. So, for example, with electron, we often talk about its spin. Like, let's say that it could either have a spin that's up or a spin that's down. And that's going to determine its magnetic field as well, right? The direction of its magnetic field that'll be determined by this electron's spin. Now, on the quantum level, technically an electron can be in superposition, meaning that it can inhabit both an upspin and a downspin at the same time. It has a probability of being in either one or the other at any given moment were you to observe that electron.
And therefore lock it into that one state or the other.
Exactly. So if you were to observe the electron would then suddenly inhabit just one of those two states, and that would be determined up by the probability of which state it was most likely to be in. Sometimes it's going to be in the less likely state. That's why there are probabilities, right? It might be a 40% chance that it'll be a spin down and a 60% chance of spin up, and you observe it and it's spin down. That can still happen, because as long as the probability exists, that's how things can sometimes shake out. Now, if you were to do that same sort of experiment over a really long run, then the probabilities would start to manifest themselves, assuming that everything else was identical, which would never happen. But anyway, superposition is that crazy idea that a subatomic particle can exist in both of these states at the same time, at least until you observe them. At which point, once you observe them, you would say that the system decoheres. It's an idea where a quantum system is a very delicate thing. And if you interfere with it in any way, if you try to interact with it in various ways, it will decohere and become a classical system where things behave more the way we would expect them to based upon our own experiences.
Mm-hmm. In terms of thought experiments, this is kind of going back to, if you've heard about Schrodinger's cat, it's you know, poking the system and seeing, you know, trying to identify what a particle is doing is going to make the cat either.
Yeah. So the basic Schrodinger's cat thought experiment is that you've got a box with uh, a, some sort of canister in it that is going to that could release a poisonous gas anytime after 30 minutes have passed. So you've got a cat inside this box with the canister of poisonous gas, and you wait for 31 minutes to pass. And at 31 minutes, there's a 50% chance that the canister has released the gas and a 50% chance that it hasn't, which means at that moment, before you open up the box and observe it, technically from a quantum level, the cat is 50% alive and 50% dead. And then once you observe it, that quantum state decoheres and it forms a classical state.
Right.
Of course, the idea of Schrödinger's cat was first introduced as sort of like a reductio ad absurdum.
Right.
The idea was like, this is so ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah. But then it turns out that
it kind of works.
Yeah. Quantum physicists were like, well, that's tough.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. On the macro scale, of course, it's ridiculous. You know, you would never say that the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. It's either one or the other. And because you open up the box doesn't change that at all. But on the quantum scale, it certainly does matter.
Okay. But so how does this relate to quantum computing? Are we giving the cat a bunch of buttons to push?
There are
no
cats in quantum computing, Lauren. I don't know where you got your notes, but let's just...
A computer without cats, I think, is a really sad idea.
I think computers are made entirely of cats,
The
Jonathan.
Internet is made of cats, not computers. No. We're going to back off the cats and the internet and the quantum computing for just a second. There's one other concept of quantum that we have to cover.
Okay.
Which is entanglement.
Oh, right.
Yeah. This is the idea of where you have multiple subatomic particles that are entangled in some quantum way. So remember when I was talking about the spin of the electron being either up or down, if you have two entangled electrons, those electrons are going to be kind of opposite but mirror images of one another, in that if you know the behavior of one, you know what the behavior of the other one was at that moment when you observed the first one.
Right.
Knowing that from that moment forward, you can't really predict anything. But if two electrons are entangled and one is spinning up, the other one would be spinning down. For that particular set of features, that's not just limited to spin. There are other things we have to take into consideration, but that goes well beyond just the basic idea of entanglement. Entanglement's very important with this. When it gets to quantum computing, the concepts of superposition, entanglement, and coherence are all really, really important. So you asked, you know, about quantum computing. That's where we're getting at. The idea of quantum computing is being able to harness these features of the quantum world in a way that can do computational work for us. And the base unit of that, you know, if you were to say the base unit of a computer is the bit, either a zero or a one, the base unit for a quantum computer is the qubit, which I had to be reminded is not a little orange guy who bounces around a pyramid.
Okay, so instead of a silicon microprocessor, say, you would have computational activities being done by something like a photon or an electron.
Or preferably lots of them.
But yes. System of them,
you would need at least two, but yes.
Yeah.
you need at least two. So what the qubits are interesting in that if a bit can only be a zero or a one, it's one or the other.
And gives you a single value.
Yes. Qubits are both zeros and ones at the same time, superposition, and technically all values in between, although that's not really that important. So the interesting thing about qubits is that the relationship between qubits and computing power is exponential. You take 2 to the power of however many number of qubits you have, and that is the equivalent of your quantum computer's power, meaning that with two qubits, you have 4 potential values there. You have to look at things as like a 2 zeros, a 0 1, a 1 0, or a 1 1. And they're all the same things. And they're all of those at the same time, right? But if you were to add another qubit in there, then you're talking about 2 to the 3rd power. So you're talking about 8 pieces of information from 3 qubits, which is different from the way it would be if it were just bits. And as you add qubits, it becomes exponentially more powerful by definition. You're talking about an actual exponent here, the n in that 2 to the nth power. So the interesting thing here is that all of these different qubits could inhabit these 2 values of 0 and 1 at the same time. If you have enough of them, then you could, in theory, run a very complex problem through a quantum computer, and it could solve for all aspects of that problem simultaneously in parallel, because it's essentially doing all of those calculations at once, because all of the qubits are all possible values. So it's kind of great for very specific types of difficult problems.
Okay, so this sounds like, though, it's not going to be a replacement for the kinds of computers we use now.
Not at all, because while it's great for certain complex problems, like the traveling salesman problem, where it could solve for all of those different variations simultaneously, it's not necessarily going to be any faster, and in fact might even be slower than a classical computer for your basic computing functions that regular schmoes like myself, like
right.
I do.
It's not going to show YouTube super fast.
You're not
like
going to be able to run the latest video game even faster. Like, I love the idea of running a video game on a quantum computer and all possible outcomes of the video game play out simultaneously. Like, I was both good and evil and everything in between. But that's not exactly what would happen.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying that a machine like this might have really incredible powers in some kind of specialized ways.
Very specialized, like cryptography.
If
we had a working quantum computer of sufficient power, cryptography as it exists now would be meaningless. And the reason for that is that basically the way cryptography tends to work is take two really large prime numbers, like really, really large. We're talking digits that are, you know, hundreds of digits long. Like, it's an enormous number. And then you find another enormous prime number and you multiply the two of them together and you get that product. And then your encryption is based upon a party that's authorized having one of those two large prime numbers. And as long as it's one of the two correct numbers, they can get access to that particular information or site or whatever. I'm oversimplifying for the purpose of this podcast. Now, publicly, all you can see is the product. So you see this huge product. I mean, it's an enormous number. Remember, it's the product of two big prime numbers. And if you don't have the information already, trying to figure out which two prime numbers made this even bigger number is really hard to do. And the way a classical computer would do it is it would start by dividing by prime numbers and then...
And would run through all of the prime numbers that it had.
Possibly
in its
could
list.
Be, yeah.
Right.
So if you pick a large enough prime number, that alone is going to guarantee that any computer working on trying to force this cryptography, this brute force style attack, is going to take longer than it would be, you know, feasible to run. So you would, you know, most people would not ever bother to try because to do so successfully would take forever. But if you had a quantum computer that could solve for all potential prime numbers at the same time, you could crack that, relatively quickly. In fact,
in a matter of seconds.
Yeah, it could make the most advanced encryption tools useless. It could also usher in a new era of quantum cryptography, which would be even more difficult to crack. But, you know, it's one of those things already where that's just one application, obviously. There are lots of other applications for quantum computing.
Yeah, that was one of the early applications, actually. In the early 90s, Peter Shor of Bell Labs developed a quantum algorithm that was a method of entangling qubits and using superposition to find prime factors of an integer.
Right.
Although that's not to say that we can run that on all of our fancy current quantum computers.
Right.
And
it was really like a proof of concept saying
right.
that once we are able to do this, it's going to change our world. And it's good to know about it now, rather than 3 months after the world's fastest quantum computer is made and then we all realize all of our stuff is public. It's better to know it now so we can say, huh, that's a problem. How do we fix this? So, I mean, but yeah, it's a great example. And a lot of work has been done on quantum computers since just that algorithm was really for a hypothetical quantum computer. But now we've got people who have actually built at least preliminary quantum computers.
Yeah, what's out there?
I think the fanciest one that we've got was built in 2007. It's called the D-Wave, and it's a 16-qubit quantum computer.
I know they were working on one that would have been 528 qubits, which would have been phenomenal, and that would have been unveiled within the last year or two, but I honestly don't know if they ever successfully demonstrated that one. But the fact that we've had people demonstrate this at all is pretty phenomenal, because keep in mind, you have to be really careful with the way you operate one of these things, because just by observing it, by trying to interpret the results, you could cause decoherence, and then you end up with a very primitive classical computer that can't do much of anything.
Right.
Like, can you imagine going from a 16-qubit computer to a 16-bit computer? Would not be great.
Right, and they've been working on these kinds of problems for since the 60s and 70s and 80s, when all of this was sort of starting to come together, and it required a lot of work in first of all bringing reversible logic gates into the computing world,
right.
which allows you if you have a one-way gate, then you're going to experience a lot of data and therefore heat loss in your computer system. Mm. Having a reversible gate lets you basically not burn out your processor every time you turn it on.
Gotcha.
Essentially. And quantum electrodynamics, which is just starting to look at how electrons and photons interact with each other so that we can start creating these little quantum pieces of electrical information.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, how do you harness this stuff? It's really tricky. You have to be able to create entangled particles. That's already kind of tricky. There are certain metamaterials that are being used right now in an experimental way that are potentially a source of entangled photons. That's pretty exciting stuff. You have to figure out how to create a system that these can work in that is not going to allow it to go into, you know, decoherence.
Right.
You have to figure out how to program for it, so again, that you can take advantage of it using it for the right sort of problems. And you have to figure out how to get the solution out of it, again, without disturbing the system, which is pretty tricky stuff. And even then, you're talking about probabilistic results, right? I mean, you're getting results that are assigned certain probabilities of being correct versus incorrect. And sometimes the probabilities you get are so high that you might as well say it's a certainty. I mean, you can't really say that. Statistically speaking, there's always some room for uncertainty. But, you know, from a human experience, it would be like, well, you know, 99.99999999999 times out of 100, it's right. But there's still a chance it could be wrong. Not all, and of course, some results may end up being like, we're 80% sure this is the right answer. So it's a very specific kind of niche-oriented version of computing. It's not something you're not going to go and get your laptop that's going to have, you know, the quantum version of the last model you owned.
Right, sure. And it is, yeah, like you said, just slow going. I mean, it wasn't until 2001 that there was a successful demonstration of Shor's algorithm, and mm-hmm. that was with a 7-qubit computer that found the factors of 15.
Yeah, factors of 15.
Well,
it's still something.
I mean, hey, no. I mean, that's impressive. I mean, I think that the very first one added 1 and 1, and everyone was so excited.
Yeah.
I mean, understandably so, but nonetheless. And there's a few different ways that you can work on this coherence problem. I think that is the largest issue that we're talking about.
Yeah. That's. I mean, none of these are trivial, but I would say that's the hardest,
mm-hmm.
or from what I understand. Keeping in mind, I'm not a quantum physicist.
Right. Because, I mean, you can like trap ions and super cool them until they're in a quantum state so that you can work with them. Or you can use liquid to kind of wrangle qubits so that you can spread a single qubit across a few different molecules, which will decrease your rate of decoherence.
Right.
But all of this is, you know, I mean, we're talking about very tricky particle physics.
Yeah, and while we're talking about, you know, kind of humble beginnings, keep in mind that other things that we depend upon today very heavily had very humble beginnings. For example, the internet. You know, if you remember back when the ARPANET was first being put into action, you know, that was a predecessor to the internet. Some people call it kind of like the grandfather to the internet. But it was a network of networks was the idea, and it was this one of the earliest messages sent, actually the first message set, ended up crashing midway through the message, and it was a one-word message. So, you know, you've got, you know, something where you point to that and like, look at that. If we had just assumed that everything that followed that failure was also going to be a failure, we would not have the internet right now. So while we talk about these kind of tiny examples, you know, when you're thinking about proving a concept to be viable, that's huge, right? Even if it seems relatively tiny and you're talking about, oh, you found the factors of 15. Wow, that's something that I learned in third grade. But, you know, for something that until that point was hypothetical, that's amazing.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, I mean, these quantum computers have a lot of interesting potential, not just in decryption or even the traveling salesman problem. Joe, you saw something, right?
Yeah, they might be able to help us actually study some things in the real world that are really difficult to study with the computers we have today, mm-hmm. or might be really expensive, say, to simulate physically. I've got a press release from last year from the NIST Information Technology Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And what this talks about is that quantum computers might be able to simulate particle collisions.
Oh,
so
awesome.
The kind of work that we have to do now with like a particle accelerator, like the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah, something that's miles across in diameter.
Yeah, could actually be simulated just
oh, wow.
in software. And of course, like with a regular computer, it's really hard to do this because digital, you know, the computers we have today can't determine all these quantum states. There's
right.
just like too much
right.
information to keep track of. But this press release talks about a team that came up with an algorithm that could basically run on any quantum computer, regardless of what its quantum hardware was. And it would simulate all of the different ways that two different types of particles could collide and interact.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, see, this is kind of fascinating stuff. The idea that we can add in all these known factors that we are aware of and create a simulation that could potentially create stuff we aren't aware of. It's kind of, to me, that's almost like magic at that stage where you're like, all right, I know what this does and I know what this does. I don't know necessarily all the things that can happen when the two collide, and you create a simulation that can actually show you that. To me, it boggles my mind. You know, it's just such a phenomenal thing. And yeah, again, the quantum computer would be a use in that situation, but not so much if you want to play Minesweeper.
Well, though, we're not saying necessarily that a quantum computer could never run a game or a video player or something like that. We're just saying, like, there's really no reason you'd need one
right.
to do that.
When a classical computer can do the same thing
probably
as well or better.
Probably much faster
yeah.
for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Because, I mean, while your power of your quantum computer does expand exponentially with the number of qubits you add, you still would have to add a lot for it to really for classical applications for it to be better than a classical computer. Now, at quantum applications, it would just leave everyone else in the dust.
It'd be screaming.
Yeah.
But you would need, you know, a whole gallon of quantum
yeah.
liquid.
Right. Yeah. You gotta get that. Gotta go over to the quantum refueling station and fill up your quantum tank and bring it back.
Just to play like Super Mario Brothers.
Yep. Oh, yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I'm ready to go and play some video games. So I'm going to wrap this up. Guys, if you enjoy our show, please go check fwthinking.com. That's our home webpage where we've got all the blog posts and videos and podcasts, cool stuff that you don't want to miss. Go check that out. And remember, you can interact with us on Google+, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for FWThinking. That's us. We're happy to talk to you. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.